Skydio stands at the forefront of autonomous drone technology in the United States, innovating with advanced AI to deliver drones tailored for law enforcement and governmental applications. Established in 2014, our expertise spans AI, robotics, and electrical vehicle technologies, enabling us to craft the most intelligent flying machines that enhance public safety and operational efficiency. Listening to Policing Matters on PoliceOne.com, and I'm your host, Jim Dudley. Hey, welcome back. If you're just checking us out for the first time, we are also on YouTube on the Police One channel, and you can take a look at me and my guest, maybe some graphics, and see what we're talking about as well as hearing us. Well, I have said that leadership begins with one as oneself in a cruiser, a one-person leadership car. Of course, it follows us through the ranks as we get promoted from managing a squad to a platoon or a unit or a station. Leadership at the level with hundreds, if not thousands, under the command calls for unique leadership skills. My guest today filled the role of the leader of the largest police organization in America. Retired New York Police Department Chief Kenneth Corey has been a leader in law enforcement for over 35 years. He managed day-to-day operations and 25,000 law enforcement professionals across patrol, transit, housing, detectives, transportation, special operations divisions with stints in training. Today, he is over a year into, quote, retirement, with a year in the role of teaching a leadership curriculum at the Police Leadership Academy in Chicago, Illinois. Well, welcome to Policing Matters, Chief Kenneth Corey.
Well, thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me on. Happy to be here.
Yeah, great. And, you know, I know you're at a conference and you're taking a niche of time to speak with us. I totally appreciate it. Hey, 25,000 people under command. How did you manage top to bottom? I was in an organization with 2,000 people, and seems like a small town compared to what you were dealing with.
Well, the NYPD actually tops out at about 55,000 when you put in all the, you know, the professional support staff in addition to the sworn officers. And you know, how do you do it? Well, listen, really one piece at a time. It's size and scale, but no matter the size of the organization you're in, you've got to have a great team around you, and you have to trust the team to execute every day. People used to use the analogy, you know, a football analogy, and they used to say the quarterback, and I would correct them. And I say, no, I'm not the quarterback, because the quarterback goes on the field and gets hit, right? I'm the manager. I'm on the sidelines. I'm calling the play. But it's really up to the team to execute that play then, right? To turn that vision into an operational reality.
Yeah, but I mean, at 25,000, your span of control in a squad, a sergeant overseeing 7 to 10 patrolmen at tops is a good span of control, manageable. You're at a position with 25,000 people. What's your span of control like? Who are your trusted leaders? How did you get the word policy level, your policy decision, all the way through the ranks so that the ground level cops would understand?
So, you know, that happened in a few ways. And it started with our bureau chiefs, right? So each of those bureaus that you mentioned, patrol, transit, housing, detectives, special operations, transportation, each had a bureau chief overseeing it, right? And of course, they advise. So that's the inner circle. That's the team that you're communicating with daily. How did you get the message down to the troops? Well, that happened in a number of ways. A lot of times that happened in one-on-one conversations. That involved me going out into the field and we're just stopping a patrol car on the street and grabbing a couple of cops and saying, hey, what's going on? In the NYPD, a big way we communicated the message was through our weekly CompStat meetings. And every precinct commander, so 98 of those, really 77 precincts, 12 transit districts, 9 housing police service area. So those 98 commanders are tuning in every Thursday morning, whether they're down there, you know, being called to account or not, to see what you're talking about. So oftentimes that's the way you delivered a message. It was right there in the room, knowing that they're hearing it and then trusting that they're going to push it down to their lieutenants, their sergeants, and to the officers in the radio cars every day.
Yeah, for sure. And when I was at the FBI Academy, I got to go up to NYPD, the One Police Plaza, and to see the Comstat roll out in that great big room that you have there. A well-tuned machine there. What was your function there at Comstat?
Well, so listen, I had the, looking back, it was the privilege. I didn't consider it such a privilege at the time, but attending Comstat meetings right from the very beginning. So I was a young sergeant, brand new sergeant, when Comstat was first introduced. I'd go down there with my precinct CO from time to time. And then as a lieutenant running a detective squad, I was down there. I was a frequent guest, you know, and called to account and explain my investigations and cases, and then up through the ranks. And then ultimately as the chief of department, I was one of the inquisitors. It was myself and the chief of crime control strategies, Mike LaPetri, who really did, you know, the questioning and drove the mission and the strategy.
Yeah, along with Jack Maple, who started out in transit.
Yeah, so Jack, I mean, the late, great Jack Maple. I mean, Jack was, you know, the visionary behind it, you know, along with Louis Anamone, who was chief of patrol at the time, later chief of department. And they're the ones who really kicked it off and changed the culture, first of the NYPD, but then really policing across the country. When, you know, police prior to that, certainly in New York, but I know in other places as well, responded after the crime was committed. And, you know, the prevailing theory amongst criminologists and academics was that the police could really have no impact on crime, right? So, you know, Jack and Lou took Bill Bratton's vision and operationalized it and proved them all wrong and, you know, really made every city in America much, much safer.
Yeah, no, I mean, the, you know, Bill Bratton, I had him on the show for a bit, and we talked about his latest book on leadership. Everyone I've talked to on leadership, and I've heard you talk about it, is mentorship. And you've mentored hundreds of leaders over your career. What's the key to being a mentor and to be successful as a mentee?
Well, so, you know, your mentees obviously have to be willing to be. All right. You've got to want to do it. You have to want to learn from somebody else. And I think many people oftentimes equate mentorship to almost like, hey, I'm going to take care of you. Right. So, you know, and that's not true mentorship. You know, the way I approached mentorship was to challenge you, to push you, to be better than you were before, better than you thought you could be, and to continually improve yourself and to watch those mentored over the years then succeed and surpass even their own expectations. I can only, you know, compare to, you know, it's like a proud father moment. It's akin to watching my own children, you know, achieve a goal for themselves. There is tremendous satisfaction in it. But that's the way it's done. You find somebody who's willing to be mentored. And I mean, really willing, not somebody who says, hey, I'd like you to mentor me because, you know, you can take care of me and help my career. No, not at all. Hey, from you, can you teach me? And then just continually challenge them and push them outside their comfort zone.
Right. I think the thought in the head of young people is, I'm a piece of clay, mold me, right? You're my mentor, right? Turn me into something. Well, it doesn't really work that way. Hey, what is the key to being a great leader in that large agency? Is it communication? Is it politics? Is it managing by walking around? I mean, I know you're a cop's cop. I know the great leaders are cop's cops. They've done the work and it shows, right? Because in our polls on Police One, we've asked, what do we want in a leader? And almost, you know, overwhelmingly, people say they want competent leaders, not just leaders who got there. And so what's your take on that? What is the key?
Well, you know, I think it's a few. And I was fortunate that I had a number of people to learn from years, all with different styles. So my own mentors, if you will, whether some of them realized it or not, I watched very closely what they did. And, you know, you obviously have to be able to connect with the officers under you, right? I mean, yes, it's a paramilitary organization. We give orders. We expect those orders to be carried out. That only gets you so far, right? That's not getting you the kind of dedication and the buy-in that you want. So you have to remember that they're people. You have to appreciate, and you should appreciate the job that they're doing every day and how very, very difficult that is. I remember So Joe Esposito, you know, the NYPD's longest serving chief of department in the department history, over 12 years in the role, nearly 13 years. He was the chief on 9/11, and for so many years thereafter. Just passed away recently, you know, as a result of a brain cancer that he developed because of his service down there at Ground Zero. But I remember watching him and at a Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade one year. And I watched him walk that parade route, which is a couple miles long. And he stopped and shook the hands with every cop out there on the parade route and thanked them for being there, thanked them for working the holiday, from being away from their family. And it was, that's the walking around, right? That's the talking to people. That's the letting people, you know, that you care about them. To be people, I think as a leader in any, organization, but well, in any police organization, it's all size and scale, whether it's large or small. To me, you had to be able to master what I call the three C's. And the first one of those was crime, right? So you had to be able to fight crime. Now, in that same crime fighting bucket, I put your bosses, the political environment, that all, you know, the internal policies, that's all that crime bucket. And listen, we had a lot of people over the years who could do that very well. They were good crime fighters. They became good crime strategists. That wasn't going to get you there. The second piece was community. You had to be able to engage effectively with the community that you were serving. And that didn't mean, you know, the friends and family, the people who always came to your meetings, right? And the people that we always relied on. That meant going out into areas where we had not gone traditionally and engaging with people and getting them to kind of differently, listen to them, hear what they wanted from their police department, and then be responsive and have that two-way communication. Explain to them why we were doing what we were doing. And then the third one was the cops. You had to be able to motivate the people who worked for you to successfully execute whatever the mission was that you wanted them to do. If you couldn't get their buy-in, you could be the most brilliant crime fighter in the world, but you weren't doing it. You relied on those men and women who were out there in the radio car or out there walking a beat to execute that mission, and you had to be able to get them on board.
Yeah, 100%. Especially number two. I mean, I think that's one of our pitfalls, is that we surround ourselves with people in this echo chamber who say the same things and want the same things we do. And it's hard to solicit our critics to find out what we're doing wrong. And we have to be prepared to hear what they have to say.
Yeah. And then listen, going into it, you know, we have to be realistic also. And you know, I use percentages. I generally go with 20%. And I would say that New York, 20% of the people love us no matter what we do, right? That's our friends and family, our supporters. Conversely, 20% of the people hate us no matter what we do. And that's the defund, abolish camp. You are never going to sway those people on either end of that spectrum one way or the other. Your target is that 60% in the middle that you hope reasonable, open-minded people, that when you talk to them and you explain things to them and you kind of pull back the curtain a little bit on some of what has always been less than transparent in law enforcement, can sit there and say, oh yeah, I can see that. That makes sense to me. But it's also being responsive and recognizing that there is no cookie cutter approach to policing, that every neighborhood needs to be policed a little bit differently. So in New York, you know, what was important in Bay Ridge didn't matter at all to people in Bedford-Stuyvesant and vice versa, right? So different standards of what constituted acceptable behavior and different priorities for how they wanted to live and what they expected from their police department, and then responding to those needs. And I used to say that, you know, policing is something that needs to be done with a community and not something that we do to a community.
Yeah, for sure. And I think your percentages work out probably the same as in recruiting, that we're always going to have that 20% who want to be cops, always the 20% who would never think of being a cop, and that 60% that we've got to appeal to. And I think we don't communicate as much as we should. And to your point about explaining things to that 60% of why cops do what they do, we don't do that enough. And I think the successful leaders do reach out and explain. And then, of course, the cops, your third C, the cops doing the work. You've got to train them. You've got to educate them. But then you've got to turn them loose, right? I mean, you can't look over their shoulder. Of course, we have supervision. But at some point, you've got to let cops have the power of discretion, no?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and that's, cops have to be able to work independently. You can't micromanage what they do. And you have to recognize that there's, you know, more than one right way to do it. You send five different officers to handle the same 911 call, and you're going to get handled five different ways. Ideally, though, you get a good outcome from all of them. And I think that's something that we haven't really done enough in policing. And today, you know, body-worn cameras give us this, fantastic tool. And I sergeants and lieutenants all the time. You know, we audited a lot of body camera video in the NYPD. We audited about 30% of the video that we looked at, right? So some of it we had to look at uses of force and arrest situations and things like that. And then they were supposed to randomly sample some other video. And my question to them was, when you look at a video and you see something that you don't like, what do you do about it? And I don't mean misconduct, because we know that we report misconduct to internal affairs and all that. And we were prepared for that. But when you see a cop who was rude, who used bad tactics, who was unnecessarily dismissive of someone, what did you do with that? And all too often, they did nothing, right? No real rule was violated, so there was no disciplinary action to impose. But I said, no, that's an opportunity to coach, to train, to change somebody's behavior that they didn't necessarily even realize was inappropriate in the first place, because they were just emulating what they saw someone else, right? Copying someone else's behavior that was incorrect to begin with. And I said, you know, it's the same reason that the coach watches the game day film, even when the team wins, right? We identify what we do really well, and we identify areas where we can improve. And I think that that's a great tool that is at the disposal of supervisors today that still isn't utilized to its fullest extent.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that coaching, teaching sort of way. I mean, that worked well with me. I remember so many of my bosses, sergeants, lieutenants, captains, chiefs. And it seemed to me that my own personal style, I responded better to somebody who said, hey, look, I need you to do this. I'm not going to tell you step by step how to do it. Just go and do it. As opposed to the screamer, the yeller, the guy over. I literally had a captain when I was a lieutenant writing an operations order, and he's leaning over my shoulder at the computer telling me, cut and paste that paragraph and bring it down here. And I couldn't wait to leave that station.
Right, right. Yeah, no, but you know, the coaching is important. And when you talk about leadership, I mean, teaching is an enormous part of leadership. And it's one of the key differences, I think, between leadership and management, right? That boss that you talked about, he's a manager, right? He's going to sit there and go through a checklist and tell you how to do things. That's completely different from leadership.
Yeah, and I actually had a chief who said, we are not leaders, we are managers. And about 10 of us in the group of 30 captains looked around the room at each other and gave each other that look. And that was a tough time too. Hey, I want to talk to you about training leaders, because that's what you're doing now. And you're doing it well, I understand, in Chicago. I want to ask about how you train and how you get across to people in positions that maybe they've been in for a while, that they think they're doing it the right way, but maybe they could use some help. But first, I'd like to take a moment and thank our sponsor. As we explore the future of law enforcement technology, let's focus on Skydio, a leader in U.S. autonomous drone innovation. Headquarters in San Mateo, California, and manufactured in Hayward, California, Skydio uses cutting-edge AI and robotics to develop drones that significantly boost the operational efficiency and safety of law enforcement agencies. Trusted by industry authorities and supported by prominent investors such as Andreessen Horowitz and NVIDIA, Skydio sets the benchmark for quality and security in drone technology. Discover how Skydio's advanced aerial surveillance capabilities are revolutionizing policing across the nation at skydio.com. That's Skydio, SKYDIO.com. And we're back, and we're speaking with Chief Kenneth Corey, retired chief of the NYPD and current director of outreach and engagement at the Police Leadership Academy in Chicago. Well, Chief, training is so important. I'm sure you've been in the room with some absolutely do not want to be there people. They always sit in the back row. How do you get them to understand the importance of training?
You know, I think it's like everything else that we do. So you've got to get them to buy into it. First of all, the training has to be high quality. And oftentimes it's not. I think many agencies don't make training a priority. It's kind of a check the box type of exercise. If you're going to stand up in a room full of cops and big city cops, you know, obviously that's my experience, but I've been around and even other departments, you know, you need two things. You know, one, your material has to be good. It has to be credible and it has to be relevant. But the person standing there delivering the training has to be credible as well, right? You know, has to have the respect of the people in there to stand in front of the room. And I would see that time and again that, you know, you'd get some cops in there, you know, some of our old anti-crime teams, you know, that went out night after night, you know, hunting for the worst of the worst, the most violent out there. And they'd go into training and sit in there and just openly question the bona fides of the instructor. Like, oh, when's the last time you were in this? To tell me how to do my job, right? You don't know. So that's key, the credibility of the instructor and the credibility of the material. But you also have to tap into the why. And for cops, you know, I used to say all the time, what do cops want more than anything else? They want to go home. They want to go home safely at the end of their shift. So if I can explain to you right out of the gate how this training that I'm about to give you helps you do your job better, keeps you safe, keeps you out of harm's way, physical harm, legal harm, administrative harm. Now I've got your attention and I have to deliver on what I just promised you. And that's the quality of the training, but that would generally get their attention.
Yeah. And that's so important, you know, in the last 5 years with COVID and George Floyd. And I think that fear of prosecution, I mean, before we used to worry about shooting the wrong person. And now we're afraid of doing things that we've been taught and working within the guidelines of the Constitution. But we have legislators who've changed some things like qualified immunity. And so are you hearing more from the police leaders in your class about how can we make cops more comfortable to do the job they need to do?
Yeah. So, well, let me explain to you, you know, probably easier if I explain to you a little bit about the makeup of the class and the program, because so the program itself actually starts, the impetus behind it is something that the University of Chicago's Crime Lab did with the Chicago Police Department in 2016. And in 2016, homicides and shootings explode in Chicago. I don't remember what the percentage was, but I mean, they nearly doubled, you know, just in a year. And they bring in Sean Malinowski, who was chief of detectives in the LAPD, to kind of advise them and help them out. And Sean, in the two of the most violent districts, 7 and 11 on the south side and the west side of Chicago, creates what he called the Strategic Decision Support Centers, or SDSC. And it's basically like a real-time intelligence center. They train up some cops to use the technology, but they also give management leadership training to leaders in those two districts. Teach them how to use data to inform their decision-making, right? Teach them about ways that they can better motivate their cops and get that kind of buy-in that we're talking about. And in a very short time in those two very violent areas, they saw dramatic reductions in shootings, homicides, and other crimes. And now we get to the cookie cutter, right? So now what does then Mayor Rahm Emanuel do? This is fantastic. I want this in all of the districts in Chicago, 22 districts. So they do. They deliver all the technology, train the cops how to use it. The part that was missing, though, they never do that management/leadership training for the commander. So they didn't replicate the results everywhere else. University of Chicago actually does a study on it because they're a big research institution, and they conclude that that was what was missing, was the training. And so that, and now from my own experience, dealing with you know, again, 98 different precinct COs in New York, I used to say we would take all of our new COs, we would put them on one of our harbor boats, take them out into the middle of the New York Bay and throw them overboard. Some of them would swim really well. Some of them would manage to tread water, but about two thirds of them would drown. And whether they swam or drowned had nothing to do with anything we did to prepare them for the role. That middle management is something that we have never invested in policing, in terms of development. Many agencies do some development for their first line supervisors. You get promoted to corporal or sergeant or whatever the rank is in your agency. Although, believe it or not, there's a large number of agencies that don't even do that, right? They just slap stripes on you and tell you you're the boss now. So they do some development there, but even the agencies that do development, that tends to focus on the same management skills, policies, and procedures that you probably had to test for to get promoted in the first place, not so much leadership. But then once you get up to that level of that middle manager, and the rank is different in every agency, there's really no development. There's a lot of development opportunities for deputy chiefs and assistant chiefs and chiefs. Yet when you look at a precinct commander in New York or a district commander in Chicago or LA or Washington or Philly and any big city police department, they're overseeing 150 or more sworn officers plus support staff, policing a community of 100,000 people. They're in a very real sense the chief of police in an average sized American city. And yet we've done nothing to prepare them for these positions. Mm-hmm. So what if we could make that leadership, that success that we saw in District 7 and 11 in Chicago, what if we could make that more intentional and less accidental? What if we gave these people the tools that they need to succeed? Could we then impact policing in a positive way? So that was the theory behind it. So Rosanna Ander, the founding executive director of the Crime Lab, is able to raise a bunch of money. She puts together a good team of people. Sandy Joe MacArthur, an assistant chief who did 35 years with the LAPD. Dr. Luann Pennell, who was the longtime training director at LAPD. They designed the curriculum, and then we bring in a whole bunch of people to teach. And what we're teaching these people, well, first of all, let me talk about the students. The students are all that operational precinct commander level person from cities and departments across the country. So in New York, often the people who got the development opportunities, who got sent away for the scholarships, and maybe they went to the Kennedy School at Harvard or, you know, SMIP, the SMIP program that PERF does. Well, that was the person who worked in the planning office, right? Somebody's office in headquarters, because we couldn't spare that operational person, right? But they're the ones who need it the most, right? As the chief, I could give orders and write policy all day long, but if my precinct commanders couldn't operationalize that, couldn't sell it to the community and motivate their cops, right, to execute that play on the field like we talked about, nothing was ever going to change. So we've got a classroom filled with people who on day one recognize that they all do the same job, just jurisdiction, different size and scale, but they all have the same role. And then they quickly learn that they all have nearly identical challenges. Mm-hmm. Right. And the challenges change over time, but they're all fighting the same challenges. And many of them have great ideas on how to address those challenges. We then educate them on things like emotional intelligence, transformational leadership, wellness, resilience, data-driven management, communication skills, how to communicate internally and externally, not public speaking, but real communications. And I say it's not training, it's education, because we train you to do a skill. And we do that usually by rinse and repeat, right? I train you how to handcuff. I train you in firearms. I train you in defensive tactics. Here, what I'm trying to do is expand your mind and get you to think about things differently. And now apply some of these lessons that we've learned when you go back home, and ideally begin to make your community even safer.
Yeah, 100%. And so are you talking about things like successful evidence-based programs, giving examples of ceasefire in Boston, things like that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Anthony Braga comes in and talks about ceasefire in Boston. You know, that's something else that we've done is we take this interdisciplinary approach to the education where the instructors coming in are, from a variety of backgrounds. We certainly have subject matter experts in policing. We had Bill Bratton come in on one of the cohorts, you know, and he did a piece. And Charlie Beck from LA is there. We have subject matter experts in other disciplines that we bring in, you know, the civil rights attorneys or people who have navigated consent decrees and reforms. But then a number of distinguished university professors as well who come in and deliver these things. So it's all evidence-based. University actually goes a step beyond that because, like I said, the university is a research institution. And so they actually want to measure the effectiveness of the program. And they have a research team assigned to it, and they're doing that in a number of different ways, one of which is a randomized controlled trial, where in the bigger cities like New York and LA and Chicago, and they actually randomize precincts against one another, right? So they have the treatment, which is the commander who came to the course, and then the control didn't. And in smaller sized cities, really, you know, an average sized American city, you know, population of 150,000 or so, department around 500, they're randomizing whole cities against one another that have very similar, you know, per capita violent crimes. One comes, one doesn't, and using NIBRS data, they're going to compare the outcomes to that over time to see whether or not the program is effective at helping to reduce violent crime and increase community engagement and improve officer morale.
Oh, great. And so what about the sort of intangibles like ethics? What's been the response to those classes?
You know, so the people in there are really, they're really good. They're really engaged. The response that we've gotten from the chiefs is really tremendous. You know, once we explain to them what we're doing, the program is a little different in that students themselves don't apply, right? So the departments reach out, they want to be considered or, you know, we've, in the beginning when we were getting started, obviously we solicited a bunch of different departments and kind of explained to them what we were doing. But then also the person that we want, because many of them, you know, right, oh, I know, I want to send my chief of staff, or I want to send, you know, the deputy chief that oversees my training. No, that's not who we want. That's not what this program is for. You know, very, very specific. The role that the person holds in the agency is really, really important to us. But they do respond. There's a lot of discussion. This is all designed to be modern adult learning. Nobody's being subjected to death by PowerPoint. Nobody's falling asleep in the back of the classroom. There's a lot of workshops involved, a lot of conversation. Some of that conversation, you know, as you can imagine, you know, there's some of the topics are controversial. And so the conversation reflects that, but that's all part of the learning process.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, you get people with differences of opinions on a subject, and that really makes the learning environment interesting. Hey, instead of the Peter principle, where we have, you mentioned it, that, you know, people are learning on their own, they're studying for the test, right? And so we give them a test and they pass everything because they can retain that subject matter for, you know, 2 days or whatever it is till they're finished with the test. And then they get out and released into the wild, into the real environment. But they're not ready. They're not ready for it. How do we get those people up to speed? How long's your curriculum? How long's your academy?
So this runs 5 months. We bring the students out to Chicago for 1 week a month for 5 months. And then there's some asynchronous coursework that we do with them when they're back at home. We don't overburden them. They do have very busy jobs and a lot of responsibility. But we do want them to stay engaged throughout and not have this be something that they only think about for a couple of days a month when they're in Chicago. So, you know, in engaging them that way, we provide them each week that before they leave us with two what we call micro trainings, which is a 15 or 20 minute curriculum that's appropriate for like a roll call training or where they could sit down with a group of their sergeants and lieutenants and kind of deliver this, you know, obviously much more condensed version of one of the topics that they learned about. To again, try to spread that knowledge down to help them to develop their subordinates as they go. And even some of the feedback on that, you know, I know in our last cohort, one of the captains talking about how I guess he did that training with, you know, 2/3 of his people, right? Because then on any given day, 1/3 of your officers are off. And when those other officers came in, they had heard about it from the others and wanted to know when they were going to get it. Great. Right. So, you know, cops really cry out for more training. It's just, how do we get it to them? You know, and compete with, particularly in this environment of agencies struggling with headcount issues and recruitment retention, some of them with increased call volume, and being difficult to take officers off patrol to do that. And, you know, I think that there's a number of innovative ways that agencies can do that and leverage technology a little bit more, but they need to really think outside.
Yeah, outside the box for sure. So my question about the Peter principle is, we get these people, we put them in positions they're not really ready for. How can we ward off from that kind of behavior that we continue to do over and over again? You talked about the people that are treading water. We put them in a position where they could tread water for a while. How do we avoid that? How do we get them better prepared?
Well, I think we need to really start developing our people from day one. You know, there's always a lot of analogies made between, you know, obviously policing and the military, although most of those analogies are unfair for a number of reasons. I think the similarities end at the fact that we have a hierarchical rank structure and, you know, and we follow orders and wear uniforms, right? You know, but one thing that the military does very, very well from your first day in is development. You know, the military in peacetime, all they do is leadership development after leadership development. And you look at, you know, General Mattis, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, he said, if you haven't read hundreds of books, you're functionally illiterate, right? The commandant of the Marine Corps has a recommended reading list for every rank, right? That you want to consider getting promoted, great. You need to read these 15 books. And they're all about leadership and philosophy and psychology and helping to develop people. We don't do that at policing. When's the last time you reading lists? But that really needs to start at the very beginning. What you're referring to there, you know, with the Peter principle, I like to refer to as civil service tragedies. You get people who are great test takers, they could memorize the material, they could pass the exam, and yet they're not really fit to lead a pack of Cub Scouts on a picnic. They have no leadership abilities, and many of them are well-intentioned to do a good job, but as a profession, we have not given them the tools that they need to do that.
So who's eligible to get to the Police Leadership Academy? You talked a little bit about the process where you picked them. What if I'm a chief and I say, hey, look, here's my new enforcement, I'm going to be going with a zone strategy, and this is my guy, I need to get him there. What do you say?
So what we do is, so any agency that's looking to, you know, send a participant, we'll be starting up a new cohort in July, and we'll be starting recruitment for that probably in March or April, you know, to fill that class, 35 seats. The way we go about that, they could certainly shoot me an email. It's korey@uchicago.edu is the email, and I'll connect them through to the team. We have a little presentation that we do to make sure and exactly what they're signing up for. You know, we select, and whether that's through the randomized control trial or it's just a straight, not every agency is involved in the RCT. So some of them we just select outright. And the operational commander is what we're looking for. So, you know, our most recent cohort just started on January 22nd. We have 35 people in there. We have about 30 of them from USA. We have a few international. We have Toronto. We have the London Met. We have the Irish Garda. And we have two Native American tribal departments as well, the Gila River and the Navajo Nation, all involved. Yeah, it's like I said, it's great. It's exciting. It's a great bunch, much like our last one. But that's our goal, two cohorts a year. Why so limited? Well, one of the other things that makes our program different, I think, than any other is we are very generously funded by philanthropy. So we cover all the expenses, and for a lot of a lot of agencies don't have the budget, particularly smaller agencies, and we don't want anybody to not be able to develop their people because they can't afford to do it. So when I say we cover the cost, that's not just the cost of the tuition for the program. We cover the travel expenses to and from Chicago. We cover the hotel, lodging, and most meals. We're not asking the agencies to outlay any money at all. And as long as we can continue to fundraise and support the program, you know, we can continue to do that.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. I read about the program. As soon as I finished, I went to look for Chief Corey to get on the show to talk about it. Thanks so much for spending time. I put a link to the program in our show notes so our viewers and our listeners can check it out and read more about it. Hey, you're doing great work there. I hope it gets replicated and some of your studies get sent around the nation, because we could sure use some evidence-based research, especially on leadership and developing our new leaders. Thanks for what you've done, and thanks for what you're doing now.
Well, thank you. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come here and talk about it. And, you know, it's a great experience, and we're looking forward to continuing it.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thanks for being on the show, Chief Kenneth Corey, retired chief of the NYPD, current director of outreach and engagement at the Police Leadership Academy in Chicago. I love Chicago. I don't know what you've heard, but I've been there. I had a chance to go there for IACP and just had the greatest week there. So check it out for sure. Thanks for listening. And let me know if you have any questions about the show. You want to get a hold of Chief Corey, shoot me an email at policingmatters@policeone.com. policingmatters@policeone.com. Hey, stay safe, and thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Take good care.